to be in orbit.
What can a cultural anthropologist teach us about UFOs? In this episode, I'm joined by Maya Cowan, a groundbreaking PhD candidate, graduate instructor, and researcher exploring unidentified anomalous phenomena through the lens of culture, ethics, and indigenous knowledge. From classroom conversations to personal experience with the unknown, Maya shares why understanding UFOs isn't just about the sky, it's about us. We talk about stigma in academia, politics behind knowledge, and why empathy and compassion may be humanity's most important tools in confronting the mysteries ahead. And now, onto our interview with Maya Cowan. So Maya, I've heard you described potentially as Amy Adams' character from the movie Arrival. Could you tell me a bit about your background and why that may be?
I don't know who would have described me as that, but not quite. I think she's a linguist in that movie, but there is some overlap between anthropology and linguistics. So I am a cultural anthropologist, and I'm in my sort of final stretch, home stretch of my PhD program here in Binghamton, New York. And I guess theoretically, were the aliens to come down to Earth, they would probably want somebody with an anthropology background to try to figure out what their culture and customs may be like, motivations and language, which was Amy Adams' job in that movie, I think.
Yeah, that's right. That's what she was doing. So if the aliens did come down, would you volunteer to do that if the government sent the black helicopters to gather you to study them? I like the fearlessness. Would you be worried about any like kind of kickback from academic colleagues or anything like that if that happened potentially?
Well, anthropology has kind of a storied history with the United States government and military anyway. So there is a quite controversial program within the U.S. military to basically have anthropologists trying to study the culture and backgrounds of particularly countries that they are fighting. And so there's a lot of controversy within the discipline of anthropology about whether or not we should, as a field, ethically be helping the military when we could potentially be putting people's lives in danger. But then the other side of that argument as well is that it's beneficial for the people, like the civilians in a war zone, in order to have the soldiers fighting them have a better understanding of their culture and of their background. So there are two sides of the argument, but it's pretty controversial within anthropology.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I never thought about it in that way. And I guess you want to preserve what may potentially be destroyed
exactly.
As well.
Well, that's the idea behind the U.S. military hiring anthropologists, but there's certainly a lot of anthropologists who feel that it would be unethical to work with any sort of military. So
interesting way of thinking about it. So tell me a little bit about your background. How did you get into what you're doing? What's your kind of origin story?
So my grandfather was like a spiritual healer, and he wrote books about dowsing and the human potential movement in a way, I guess you could call it. And he was also a major experiencer of different sorts of paranormal phenomena in his life. And so from the time I was a little kid, I was always really interested in it. I remember watching documentaries and things like that. But it was only after I had been following along everything that was happening with the developments in the scientific community, and I had been working on a completely different PhD project, that I decided to go for it and ask my supervisor if he would let me switch topics. And he did let me switch topics, and so here I am studying UAP from the anthropological sort of perspective on expertise and the development of expertise within a sort of emerging field of UAP studies.
That's ridiculously cool, and thank you for, you know, kind of putting your professional weight into the subject, because I think it's emerging at the moment, right? Like it's going from something that people snicker at and there's a lot of stigma around to something that there may potentially not be. And it's people like yourself
coming into it that changes that conversation, I think.
Yeah, I hope so. I'm teaching a course about UAP and sort of the paranormal and the anthropological perspective on these things in, I think, like about a month now at my university. So that should be exciting and fun.
Have you had, you say that your father kind of had some paranormal experiences. Have you ever kind of had experiences yourself or been in places that you potentially could?
It was my grandfather who... I've definitely had some odd experiences. When I was with my younger brother, when we were kids, we saw like some sort of craft or balloon or something in the sky. And I kind of remember just getting like freaked out and running home. We were walking home from a friend's house. And so that definitely intrigued me. I don't, you know, claim to know that it was an alien craft or anything. And I can't really remember that much about it because I was pretty small, but that definitely, yeah, it was kind of probably a formative experience.
So that's your grandfather, your brother, you said was with you for that one. Is there something that runs in your family?
I think it must be, because there's definitely other people in my family who have had strange experiences as well. Like I've had, since I started researching this topic, I've had like some cousins and other people reach out to me and say that they've experienced things. So
you're kind of like becoming a magnet for UAP experiences and stories being told to you.
That's definitely true in my life in general. Since becoming open about the subject, a lot of people have reached out to me about experiences that they've had, and even just online and things like that, people will drop me a line and share me some photos of something strange they saw or something like that.
Yeah, that's really cool. And it's cool that you're open to that conversation as well. Even though, you know, doing this, I get some people to send me some things and I'm like, I can look at it and my guess is really as good as yours. You know, it's something in the sky unless I was there. But I can't say yes or no.
Totally. It's definitely, I think, important, though, for a lot of people to be able to talk about it, because there's just so much stigma around the topic that coming out about it, it, you know, it's kind of a gamble one way or the other. So it's nice, I think, like for people like my cousin had this really crazy experience in the 80s. And so I think it was nice for her to be able to talk about it with someone who she knew for sure wasn't gonna say that she's crazy, because she's told a lot of people and been told that she's crazy.
Yeah, absolutely. And lots of people that have these experiences, you know, they don't ask for them, and more often than not they kind of have a really negative impact on people's lives, so they're reluctant to share them, you know, and then people think they're making it up just for money or something.
Yeah, which I don't know where the money is supposed to be coming from, but it can be really isolating. For sure.
What drove you to study anthropology?
Well, I was a theater major, and pretty quickly in theater school, I knew that I really didn't want to work in theater. And so I was kind of looking around for a new major, thinking that I might want to go to law school or something like that. And one of my roommates was studying anthropology at the time. And I asked her, I didn't really even know what it was, but I asked her, like, what kind of stuff do you talk about in anthropology? What do you learn about? And she told me, study archaeology, and there's like forensic anthropology and cultural anthropology, which is studying different cultures from all around the world. And I thought, like, okay, that sounds really interesting. So I switched into the anthropology major without ever having taken an anthropology course. I thought probably I'd go to law school or something like that, but I just kind of fell in love with the study of it and decided to go to grad school for anthropology instead.
That's really cool. Was there any particular culture when you heard about that you were itching to go study, or was it just a blanket everything for you?
I would say at first there wasn't like any particular culture that I found specifically intriguing, but I did go into it thinking that I would want to study archaeology, and then I ended up getting really interested in economic anthropology within the cultural anthropology program, which is sort of the study of money as a social system instead of just looking at it from like a pure sort of numbers perspective like you would in economics.
That's really interesting and unusual way of applying economic theory, I guess. I'm a big fan of things like Freakonomics, where you kind of take those ideas and you apply them and see what information emerges. I remember reading about, you know, South America and, you know, the cultures that made Machu Picchu and places like that, and how they had just monetary systems that we would basically be kneecapped if we tried anything like that in the modern world, where, you know, you exchanged work for goods instead of having these gold coins that we pay for things with.
And that's pretty common in different societies throughout the world or throughout history, is to have a more sort of gift-based economy where people kind of just like give each other things more or less. And the expectation is that other people will give you things in return when they have an excess of something and you're in need of something.
Yeah, it's interesting. It sounds like it would be, I don't know, a better world than the one that's kind of full of chaos for us at the moment.
Yeah. You could make a strong argument for that.
Let's talk about the various costs of studying the unknown, kind of both literal and figurative. So we get these ideas kind of thrown around a lot of, you know, if the US government found an alien body and they wanted to study it, it would cost bajillion dollars to even start to study the DNA. Is that true? Like, what would the practical kind of process look like there, and how much would it cost?
I don't have the exact figures, but I'm always confused by what the calculus goes into when people do have this idea that it is going to cost a bajillion dollars to study an alien body. Because I think if that were true, it would be unfeasible to even train new professionals within the study of like ancient DNA, for example. I think there's also a lot of confusion about what constitutes ancient DNA. Really, any DNA profile that's taken off of something that's already dead is considered ancient DNA. Like okay. I don't think it would be, you know, entirely unfeasible or prohibitively expensive, partly because, like, I have somebody on my committee who is an ancient DNA specialist. I have a good friend who is doing his PhD program studying ancient DNA. And, you know, I think if it really costs millions of dollars, they probably wouldn't let him run.
Sure.
For example. But, I mean, these are figures that you can look up online as far as, like, what private laboratories charge for ancient DNA profiling. It's done all the time for like law enforcement, for example, cases of, you know, you find someone who has died and you don't know who they are, and it's well past the point of being able to identify them through any other means.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I had no idea that ancient DNA was referred to in that way. That was how you designate it. Just anything that's dead. So it could be yesterday, it could be a million years ago. Just the term ancient DNA just means has passed away previously. Is that right? Okay, that's good to know. Because there's all this, like, you know, people often throw around the word. I find, like, people will say, oh, I have a hypothesis. And science means something different when they say hypothesis to what the common person says when they... what it means when they say hypothesis.
Right, exactly.
And obviously, like, we've touched on it briefly already, but there's a lot of stigma in studying the unknown. So I kind of wanted to ask you, how come you're so brave with it? How come you're open when others aren't?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I can't assign motivations to anybody else for not wanting to get involved with the stigma, and I think it's pretty understandable why somebody wouldn't want to personally, but I guess the answer is that I've kind of just always been openly interested in this topic, like with people in my life, and so it wasn't such a big reach to say, you know, professionally I'd like to study this. I also am not very married to the idea of remaining in academia, so I guess it hasn't really bothered me, the idea that I wouldn't be allowed to remain in academia because I had studied this topic for my PhD.
How do you think academics or academia at large could better study the UFO phenomena?
It's a difficult thing within academia, I think, because, well, there's a number of reasons why it's difficult. Part of it is for sure just the stigma is very real. Part of it is the way that the academy is organized according to different faculties and departments and disciplines. It's very narrow. Like if I want to study it from an anthropology perspective, in order for it to be an accepted sort of way of practicing my discipline within academia, there's only a certain limited number of ways I can really get to look at this topic. The same would be true in a physics department or a mathematics department or philosophy department or religious studies department. What we really need to study this topic, I think, is something that's more transdisciplinary or interdisciplinary, where you have people from different perspectives sort of looking at it and really thinking across disciplinary lines about how to collaborate and how to think about these ideas in a bigger way, which is difficult within academia.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, there's only certain tracks you can go on that I guess would be established already. I love space and, you know, the James Webb Telescope and things like that. And each year I feel like we're kind of getting to these, you know, exobiologists is kind of a recent term that popped up as a job title, and just new jobs are kind of coming all the time, the more we find and the more we know. So that makes sense to me.
Yeah, definitely. It really does require new and innovative ways of thinking and looking at the subject.
One thing I've noticed in ufology or in the UFO community is there seems to be kind of the two sides are allergic to each other. You know, people in the UFO kind of business always say, like, we want scientists to study this. But I found that a lot of times when the scientists come to study it and they share their points of view on the data and they don't align with kind of the, you know, the big broad swings of ufology, they'll be attacked for even daring to kind of come study the subject or saying, have you had any experience with that kind of thing? Like, I know recently, trying to think from an anthropological perspective, we had the Peruvian mummies, for example, come out, and a lot of people who are very qualified to speak on them have phooey'd the idea, but then there are some really passionate individuals that just want to ignore tenured professionals speaking out that they're probably a hoax.
Yeah, I mean, it's a difficult thing. I mean, I've seen some pushback. People will say, we want scientists to study this, as you mentioned. But then when they don't like what the scientists have to say, it can be sort of a different matter. The Peruvian mummies there's definitely a lot of overlap with the UFO world when it comes to those. But then I've also heard claims that they're supposed to be another species of human that evolved alongside Homo sapiens on Earth. So I'm not really sure what the dominant perspective is, for sure. And I do think that more scientists should be willing to dive in and take a good hard look at them using the tools of science. With the Peruvian mummies in particular, something that is really concerning to a lot of academics who otherwise might be willing to study this sort of topic is that, from my understanding, the Peruvian government has basically said that they want the bodies returned to Peru as part of the cultural heritage because the origins are a little, frankly, dubious. And if you can't establish provenance of these bodies, if regardless of, you know, what they are, hoaxes or authentic specimens, if we're being told that they've been removed from an indigenous community without proper consent and without the consent of these communities to study them and to do this science, then there is a perspective from anthropological ethics that I would say is probably the dominant perspective, which is that we don't really have a right to study them either way and that they should be repatriated and returned to their communities.
Yeah, I can agree with you on that. And I recently went to the British Museum in London, and it was wonderful to see everything. But, you know, I stood there looking at a Moai statue that was literally dragged off Easter Island with ropes by a passing ship. And I'm like, we should probably give that back, right? Like, that's, we just stole that.
Yeah, yeah, the British Museum is, I've been there as well. It's, in a way, it's a really wonderful museum. And I mean, wonder in the way of, like, you know, it, there's just so many artifacts and they are incredible to look at, but they're also all just stolen from these communities. And certainly with the perspective from anthropology, you would want to see those returned and repatriated to the communities that they were stolen from. When it comes to the mummy artifacts, like, there's certain dating techniques that you really need to kind of know the provenance of where an artifact was situated in order to really be more confident about the dating methods that you're using in archaeology. So that's definitely another consideration of it. There's also a legal question about it that I don't know the answer to this, but it's something I've often wondered about with the Nazca mummy specimens in particular, is whether they would even legally really be allowed to be studied in the United States, because the United States has something called NAGPRA, which is the Native American Graves Repatriation Act, I believe is what it stands for. And so when that was introduced, it basically gave a legal imperative to archaeologists and biologists and, you know, anatomists and anybody else who might be studying bodies that were stolen from Native American communities. It basically said, like, you have to give them back to the communities of origin. Like, you can't have these bodies without the consent of the communities that they were taken from. And so, you know, a lot of collections had to be turned back over so that the communities could handle the remains in whatever way was culturally appropriate for them. And so I just don't know, because I'm not an archaeologist, I'm not a legal expert, if NAGPRA would also theoretically apply to remains that were taken from indigenous communities in another country. But it is a serious question, and it either way does come back to the sort of ethical problems potentially.
Yeah, that's interesting. I don't think when people think about, you know, aliens coming down, these kind of things are at the back of their minds. You know, they're thinking of the dramatic swings of what would happen instead of the ethics and the legal ramifications and things like that. It's really interesting.
And I think obviously there's, I think there's part of that is there's this idea that if we're being visited by beings from another planet, or by something that perhaps evolved naturally on Earth alongside human beings, that they probably are a lot smarter than us if they managed to get here and evade our detection. And so people don't necessarily think about the ethics in the same way, because I think there's an assumption that they would be, you know, much smarter than us anyway. So, like, there's more of an idea that they would be concerned with the ethics of studying us than that we would be concerned with the ethics of studying them, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's funny to think about, because, you know, that's kind of anthropomorphic in a way, right? To think like, oh yeah, whatever species comes down is going to think in exactly the same way we think. You know, people always say, is a UFO going to land on the White House lawn? Who's to say they'll even recognize what the White House is or what the borders between countries are?
Yeah, exactly. You know? I think even when you look at the diversity of human ontology and human thought, you know, it's pretty easy to see that there's no one way of being and looking in the world. Even within the borders of the United States, you know, there's such a vast diversity of perspective on religion and ontological worldview and all of these different questions that it certainly is difficult to predict, let's say, how a completely other species would think and act.
Yeah, absolutely. I saw that you wrote, I was looking at the course, you know, that you're doing with the Coalition for UAP Studies, and I saw that you'd written that UAP and space exploration sometimes mirrors the ideals of settler colonialism. Would you mind elaborating on that a little bit?
Yeah. So there's actually a really great issue of, I think it's the Journal of American Indian Studies or something like that. I would have to double check, but it certainly would be on the syllabus for that course that you'd be able to find that. And I think that this particular issue is open source as well, if people are interested in reading more about it. But there was a project through, I think it was just the SETI Institute a while back, where they sort of convened a group of indigenous scholars from North America and asked them to basically write a statement on the ethics of space exploration from an indigenous perspective, indigenous studies perspective. And, you know, in this original statement that they wrote, they were quite critical of it and said that it needs to be approached in such a way that, you know, we're not just looking at space exploration as, like, quote unquote, the final frontier. We're not just looking at it from the perspective of what we can potentially exploit from other cultures and other planets that we could think about visiting that would be potentially inhabited by life. And so, yeah, so they were quite critical in their original statement. There's also some politics around things, like one of the articles talked about, I believe it was an observatory that was built, like a telescope that was built in Hawaii, that built on indigenous land without permission, and how, you know, there are sort of all of these pitfalls along the way of thinking about this sort of human future of answering the question, are we alone? And not only are we alone, but how could we potentially get to contacting these other cultures, these other planets, these other beings, supposing that we're not alone, and what should that look like so that we're not doing it in a way that is mirroring the real horrors of the colonial project.
Absolutely. It's definitely worth us all kind of remembering that everyone's an alien somewhere, right? And when we go to these other planets and we go to these other cultures, even on our own planet, that we should tread kindly and carefully and not just exploit there. So given the moment we're recording this, what's going on in the world with cuts to science and people so readily questioning science, can you speak to how politics can influence the creation of knowledge?
There's always a politics behind knowledge creation. Who gets to decide what is considered knowledge or fact, right? In a way, it is always influenced by power, whether that's the power of a dominant ontology that might have shaped your way of thinking about a certain subject, or whether that is a politics of being told by an outside influence to stop thinking that way and to start thinking a different way, think according to my beliefs, actually. I mean, part of it is that there's just a shift happening for a lot of people in how they know things, and they don't necessarily trust science when maybe they once did, or there's communities that have perhaps never really trusted science that are now just being more open about that and more open about asserting their belief in other things besides science, such as like religion, or in the case of like politics around vaccination, for example, like bodily autonomy is certainly at stake for a lot of people, they feel. And so it certainly is, you know, there is one side that is saying to another side, believe according to the way that I believe, which is scientifically, and a group that's saying no and pushing back against that. And I think that the louder that disagreement has gotten in a way, the more and more inflamed the situation has become is certainly part of the issue at stake. But in a sense, this isn't new. Science obviously came to be the dominant worldview through its own power dynamics and politics throughout the Enlightenment. And there was certainly a lot of extreme pushback to it back then, you know.
I'm wondering, you know, how that can influence studying the unknown. And by unknown, I don't just mean UFO stuff, you know, any language that, any knowledge that is beyond humanity, how that could impact studying that.
Yeah. I mean, in a way, it probably makes it easier if you're suddenly in a situation where perhaps like what was once considered more fringe is now more mainstream. Yeah, I mean, that would be my guess about the matter, but I'm not entirely sure that I have all the answers on that.
No, it's really interesting, and you've got a lot of insight from your perspective. Like you said, we all need to work together, right? Like at the beginning of this, we mentioned the movie Arrival, and that's kind of the spoilers if you haven't seen it, but it's been enough time now, I think, that any listener can, you know, endure the spoiler. But, you know, every country has its own puzzle piece, and they all have to work together to figure out the issue. You're familiar in your work with indigenous groups and peoples, you know, cultures. We've touched on that. So what are some indigenous ideas about the UFO phenomena?
I would want to refer people to the work of, like, Artie Sixkiller-Clark is probably the best example as far as somebody who has written a lot about the subject. And I mean, there are a huge diversity of perspectives between indigenous groups for sure, but there are a lot of cultures around the world that do have traditional beliefs about star people, for example, is the title of one of her books. People will say, well, why is it always white Americans out in the sticks who see craft or who have encounters with these beings and stuff like that? And it's just really clearly shown time again in the literature that that's not the case. And in fact, that, you know, many indigenous groups have their own entirely developed systems of knowledge around these encounters, and that they, in fact, do have these encounters, have had these encounters, have these encounters on an ongoing basis. In particular, the introduction and conclusion to the book Star People by Artie Sixkiller-Clark, I would say, gets a lot into sort of summarizing, yeah, these belief systems. And then the center of the book is individual encounters that people reported to her as she was doing this ethnographic work of collecting stories from people.
That sounds really cool. I'll definitely look out for that, and we'll put the link in the description so people can go and check out that work too. I love that, many indigenous peoples call the visitors star people. In Wales, we don't have a word for extraterrestrial, so we just say Pobl Seren, which is star people. So we kind of share that.
That's exactly it, I think.
And it's evident then that many cultures have different names for the same kind of phenomenon. So any project where we tackled, you know, figuring this out, what the puzzle is, there would need to be an aspect of, you know, cultural study, like anthropologists involved, you know, on that specific part, to just almost translate the terms so we can kind of say, you know, this thing. For example, I was in Colombia making a TV show about some lights on a mountain that we just called UFOs. But when we were there, the peoples referred to them as ancestor lights, and they were the spirits of their ancestors, and aliens didn't come into it, you know? So many indigenous peoples have really interesting and provocative origin stories that I find kind of get dragged into the UFO community as explanations for where these beings come from and stuff like that. And some of them, you know, can hold some truth. Some of them can be metaphorical. And I was just wondering, as someone that's kind of looked into this, how do we decipher whether these ideas and origin stories and myths passed down are stories or metaphorical or religion?
What I think sometimes gets lost when we're talking about cultural things is talking about ontology and ontological differences. It's like these things are literally true to the people within a certain ontological worldview. And the way that it's like literally true to someone in my ontological worldview that the sky is blue, like, you know, there's, these are just like facts of how things are, to the same way that it is like literally true to somebody who is Christian, that God is real and Jesus is our Lord and Savior. Like, these things are literally true. And so I think what often gets lost is that piece of what's going on and how these are really major differences. But then, you know, I think it gets difficult because then there is an aspect to studying them that's challenging, and to comparing them that's challenging, because they really can have a lot of similarities. They can also have a lot of differences. And it's just sort of a situation that I think personally kind of needs to be treated on a case-by-case basis. And most importantly, with the input from people who actually are from these cultures and hold these ontological facts as true.
Yeah, I completely agree. I was watching Graham Hancock's recent show on Netflix. I forgot what, Ancient Apocalypse, that's what it's called. And in series two, he spent so much time talking to indigenous peoples, you know, people that lived in these places, and talked to the people that made these kind of incredible megaliths. And the person would explain exactly, you know, what the people who made them thought they were. And then Graham would very quickly go, yeah, that's cool. And then he'd be off kind of putting his own theory forward and essentially steamrolling over the actual history and facts that were there.
And that's a huge challenge in this community, and it happens a lot. It's, you know, like, there is an aspect to it that is comparative, and it's interesting to talk about the similarities and differences, but then we do often get to a place where it does end up just, you know, steamrolling people's own beliefs and traditional knowledge. And that goes back into the challenges with, you know, the politics of knowledge and knowledge creation, especially in this community.
Yeah, absolutely. And a massive part of any culture is language. And I wanted to ask you, how do we even categorize and begin to study languages? Are there specific types of language, or is it a case that you start from scratch with every single one when you're trying to decipher it?
This is definitely not my specialty. But there are, I mean, there's different language families and categories and ways that language can kind of be traced and tied together in a lot of different ways. But then there's also a handful of languages around the world that don't seem to really have any specific ties to like other languages in that, in the family, that's perhaps more common in that region. And so it's kind of a mystery as to how people came to speak this particular language in this particular area. Yeah, there's definitely, there are techniques that can be used and have been used by anthropologists to sort of decipher a language from scratch. And that's certainly, that is what Amy Adams was doing in Arrival, for sure. But
yeah, it's just the ultimate puzzle, isn't it? Does that change with something that would be like a non-verbal language? So I know, like, some writing, some languages can only be written as opposed to spoken, and vice versa.
Yeah, so there's kind of like different components to languages and to like the syntax of a language and things like that, that you would look for to be repeating patterns more commonly. And I know that was the main challenge in the movie Arrival, was that their language worked in such a totally different way from human language that it was quite a complicated project to try to figure this out. But looking for sort of patterns and repetitions, I think, is mostly the first sort of step. Like, I remember taking a class in anthropological linguistics in my bachelor's program, and they discussed basically how this was done traditionally in the anthropological field. And it's like, you first kind of start with the international phonetic language, and you're just writing down what phonemes people are saying and looking for repetitions and things like that. So, but it's definitely difficult. I don't envy the people whose job that is.
Yeah, me neither. I wouldn't have a clue where to start with it. The most language deciphering I've done was in Guardians of the Galaxy, you know, the Marvel movie. They put just a, it was a straight cipher, you know, the letter A for a symbol. They kind of scattered those symbols all throughout the movie. I managed to put it together and create, you know, something, a decoder for the language in the film, which was kind of cool. I got a tweet from Stan Lee, for that. So that was kind of cool, but yeah, that's the most. And that was really straightforward, right? Just the A for A, you know, whereas other things get so much more complicated. In the movie Arrival, it was that the language was meant to be read all at once, right? Like the sentences were backwards and forwards. There was a temporal aspect to them. And it used this idea of something called the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis, which was the idea that your language can influence how you see reality or worldview or cognition. Is that a real thing, do you know? Or is it just what we were saying before about how a culture and how politics influence how you see the world?
It's a really good question. I don't know like what the state of the debate is on the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis within linguistics or within linguistic anthropology and how it's kind of currently viewed. I mean, I think there's a level to which it kind of has to be true, right? Like if you don't have terms for the number of things in your language, then you're not going to be counting things, right? Like it's just...
Sure, yeah.
But I'm not sure... I'm not sure, you know, some of the bigger questions about if you speak a romance language, you're more likely to think in this way or what have you. I'm not sure how true those are considered.
A friend of mine from Spain, she told me that she realized that she'd learned English properly and could be a fluent speaker when she started dreaming in English. That was her line for her.
Right. I've heard people say kind of a similar thing before. Like, you don't really know a language until you start thinking in the language and dreaming and that kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. She also gave me the advice that if you want to be relaxed when you're talking to people that speak a language you're learning fluently and you're like intimidated, to get really drunk. Apparently that just takes the blinders off and lets you relax. So I read something about something called the Zipf correlation, which I thought was interesting. And I wondered if you were familiar. And it basically was the idea that distribution of complex language between humans and dolphins and other things are similar in how much information they convey. And I was wondering if, one, you're familiar with it, and if, two, that Zipf correlation could be a kind of subtle fingerprint for high-level intelligence in a species.
That's interesting. I haven't heard of the specific hypothesis, but I think I'm kind of familiar with the conversation that you're referring to and the argument. I do think we kind of tend to think about it as a marker of intelligence because it's like you're conveying more information than, for example, like dogs seem to be conveying when they are together in a pack or something like that. I don't even know what else to compare it to. Or that, you know, bumblebees are communicating to each other when they're talking about where to go to find nectar. But I think it's different. It's difficult because what it really brings up is this higher level question about consciousness and the nature of consciousness and the nature of communication, because, you know, they do seem to be conveying perhaps similar levels in terms of complexity and the language or the information that they're conveying through their language. But then in order to say that necessarily, you know, correlates with intelligence, I think that's a more difficult question to answer and probably one that we would need to understand a lot more about consciousness in order to find the answer for.
Yeah. I almost find that conversations about UFOs almost become philosophical in nature when we kind of talk about things like consciousness and intelligence. So you have to really drill in on, well, what does intelligence mean? What does consciousness mean? And we don't really have those definitions, yeah. You know?
It's definitely, you know, difficult to say. And I think that at this point, we probably mostly are dealing in theories.
So for you, what does UAP and the associated phenomena mean for the future of humanity?
That is a big question.
It is.
I mean, I think there is this potential for these questions about the unknown and about consciousness to really sort of unlock a deeper level of relating to each other. And it seems like people who go through these experiences often have a deep level of empathy and compassion for their fellow human beings that get conveyed through these experiences, or that's certainly like a common theme in experiencer narratives. And that's, you know, that's exciting and potentially important for our future as we, you know, navigate choppy waters and often seem to be getting less kind to one another.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe a North Star, like facing another species and having to think about ourselves, could be more of a centering experience for some
it
of
certainly
us.
Certainly could be. It seems, yeah, it seems like there's some potential there.
Are you following along with this kind of government UFO disclosure with people like David Grush coming forward with his stories and Lou Elizondo and people like that? What do you think
definitely.
Of that?
I mean, I think it's exciting to just see, you know, any situation that sort of seems to open up the wider conversation about it and decrease the stigma is definitely interesting and exciting to me as somebody who has long been interested in it.
Very cool. I'm glad that you're following that and kind of keeping up with it. There's just so much to follow, right? Like, I never know. Someone will come out and I'll be like, who is this person? Do I believe them? Where do they come from? Is anyone vouching for them?
It can be for sure difficult at times.
So if you could, this is a big question. If you had the means to influence the world, what would you do first to unite humanity? Would it be bringing aliens to push that, or would you do something else?
If I said that, I think that would be pretty controversial because of all the conversations around ontological shock that are being had. I would bring in something that would make people nicer to one another and more compassionate and understanding of their fellow human beings.
Sure, yeah. And anything that promotes, you know, altruism and kindness, I think that's the direction that we should be following. Okay, so last question for you, Maya. Given all that we've discussed and all of your work, it makes me think about our own identity of humanity, you know, looking back on ourselves. Who are we? Why are we here? Everything like that. And I was wondering for you, with your experiences, what do you think it means for us to be human?
I mean, I feel like that question, once again, gets kind of more and more difficult the deeper you drill down into it. But as an anthropologist, and as a scientist, I tend to first think that, you know, the genus Homo is how I would define a human. But, I don't know. I think human beings are certainly, as far as we can tell, have been very unique on this planet in our complex ability to relate to one another, and sometimes that's positive and sometimes that's negative, but it certainly seems to be the underlying thread.
Do you think we're on a trajectory for that to be a positive thing or a negative thing, or balanced?
I mean, it's difficult to say. I think that, you know, at different points throughout human history, it looked to be on a more positive trajectory, and at certain points throughout human history it's looked to be on a more negative trajectory. I don't really want to say how it's looking now, great a lot of the time, but I kind of tend to be optimistic about people's ultimate ability to care for one another at the end of the day.
That's beautiful. I like that. I think we'll call that the finish line there, to have a nice positive end. And thank you so much for joining me, Maya, for coming on and sharing your perspective. It's really important, and I'd love to have you back again in the future as we kind of go down this road, digging up UAP and mysteries.
Yeah, thank you very much. Yeah, it was great talking to you.
Thank you so much for joining us in this conversation where culture, consciousness, and the cosmos meet. Maya's journey reminds us that the search for understanding of UAP, intelligence, and our place in the universe isn't just about evidence. It's about ethics, story, and perspective. In a world shaped by politics and perception, it's the willingness to listen to other cultures, to the past, and to each other that may guide us forward. Because in the end, how we relate to the unknown might just shape the future of humanity. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review on Spotify or on your chosen platform. If you could like, share, or subscribe, that would be very much appreciated. It helps us find our tribe. If you'd like to support the show and get access to a 1-hour live chat each month and early ad-free access, you can find us at Patreon. Just follow the link in the show notes or at our website, tobehumanshow.com. And feel free to reach out via the contact page or email at hello@tobehumanshow.com. You can also find us on Blue Sky, Threads, Instagram, or X at tobehumanshow. As always, remember to be curious. The universe is bigger than we know.
What It Means to Be Human is a Double Barrel production. This week's episode was produced by Roz Mugford and Dan Zetterstrom. Sound post-production by Parker Mosley, with technical support from Dale Mugford. Our theme music is by Thunderbird.